You're listening to a proud member of the Dice Tower Network, dedicated to bringing podcasters together for the greater good of gaming. It's sort of like Voltron, but with better lip syncing. Find out more at dicetowernetwork.com.
We made it. We made it past episode 250. We are still alive. We are still here. And now we've got an odd-numbered episode.
Speak for yourself. I don't think I'm here.
It's been a long week, but we are here. Hello, everybody. We are the Family Gamers. I am your host, Andrew. And as always, I am joined by my lovely and wonderful wife, Anitra.
That's me.
And because it's an odd-numbered show, we do have a special guest on the show. This week, we got fancy this week. We have the tabletop bellhop, Mo Tucino, on the show. Hello, Mo. How are you doing tonight?
How are you? I am great. This is fantastic. I'm excited to be here. I am Mo Tucino, the tabletop bellhop, your cardboard concierge, answering your game and game night questions and striving to make everyone's gaming experience better. So I am looking forward to seeing how I can make your game night better.
It sounds like you're practiced at this.
I love it. I love it. It's awesome. It makes me feel so important that I have a special concierge now.
For the next 45 minutes.
For the next 45 minutes.
Yes.
All right. But first, we would like to let you know that the Family Gamers Podcast is sponsored by First Move Financial.
Did you know that risk, when it comes to investing, is anything happening other than what is expected? So that stock you bought went up more than you thought it would? That was still risk at work, with the return deviating from the mean. Now, let's do a small sample experiment, Andrew.
Okay.
If I offered you a wager on a coin flip, where heads you lose $100 and tails you gain $150, would you take that wager?
Well, the computer scientist in me would scream and yell and say that mathematically it's 50-50 and you're going to win more than you lose, and so you should take the wager, but probably I just wouldn't take the wager.
Right. Most people don't like that wager because the quick internal math says losing $100 feels bigger than possibly gaining $150. Or you could also be falling for the sunk cost fallacy, that the money you already have is worth more than the money you don't. Either way, this shows how most people are loss averse, not risk averse. The amount of loss aversion you have should influence how you invest, how much insurance you own, and how much you have in your emergency fund. Knowing more about ourselves and how we instinctively react will help us make better financial decisions in the future. If you want to talk to someone about your natural money instinct, reach out to First Move Financial by going to firstmovefinancial.com/familygamers and schedule a time to talk.
Thanks so much to the team at First Move Financial for sponsoring this episode of the show. You know, one thing I really love about that is that they don't say which one is right or wrong, because it's really a preference.
Right. There is no right or wrong there.
Right. And I think that's a really cool thing about what First Move Financial does. All right. So, Mo, this is episode 251. Odd number of guests. That's how it works. My fact this week is about the Freedom 251. Do you have any idea what the Freedom 251 is?
Is that the cell phone that came out of India?
Oh, it is the cell. I'm so impressed that you did. You Google this? Did you look this up, or you just knew this?
Someone sent me show notes ahead of time, and I was able to see that there was a question.
Dang, so it! No,
I'll admit a big part of being a concierge is being able to do the research ahead of time to be able to answer the questions.
That is true.
That is very, very true. By the way, I have to ask this question: have you ever seen the show Jeeves and Wooster?
No, I have not.
Oh, you have got to see this show.
I actually just watched an episode tonight.
Oh, did you really?
Yes.
Okay, so it's Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry.
When they were young.
Okay.
And Hugh Laurie plays this rich playboy who is just completely useless, and Stephen Fry plays his butler, his concierge, who is, you know, clever and smart and a little bit smug, but in all the, you know, ways that are, like, really, like, appreciable. Mm-hmm. And it's just a fantastic and hilarious show, and I strongly recommend it to anybody who's listening.
He is significantly smarter than his employer, but is always looking out for the greatest good of all people involved.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a ridiculous show. It's great. I think it was on probably BBC because everything
was on BBC. It was originally
BBC,
yeah.
So,
it's based on a series of novels by P.G. Woodhouse.
Well, there you go. Anitra knows more than I do, but hey, what are you going to do? That's,
there you go. You got two facts.
That's not uncommon, yeah. So anyway, so you've got a concierge fact, and now the Freedom 251. Okay, so the Freedom 251 was a smartphone that was initially offered for sale in India at the promotional price of 251 rupees.
Okay. Makes sense.
That's where the number comes from. Now, that's like $4 to put it in perspective.
I can see selling a phone for $4.
This is a smartphone.
But not a smartphone.
Right. Okay, so here's the thing. It was sold by Ringing Bells Private Limited, and it was marketed as the world's cheapest smartphone. And this was like way back 5 years ago in 2016.
That doesn't feel like 5 years ago.
I know.
We were just getting started with the Family Gamers.
I know. And we had no idea that this kind of nonsense was going on the other side of the world.
Yeah.
So here's where it gets really interesting. So the promotional price was offered for a limited time to only online bookings between February 18th and February 21st.
Okay, so 3 days.
Yeah. Traffic was so high on the website that it crashed on the first day. The company planned to sell 5 million phones by June of that same year. But by the time it crashed, it had only taken 30,000 orders. Big difference.
Okay, yeah.
By the time bookings closed, Ring Bell said that they had taken 175 million rupees worth of orders.
That math doesn't add up.
Well, obviously it was more than the third. Like they must have implied that they got it back up or whatever. But yes, you're correct. The math doesn't seem to work out here. So the ICA, the Indian Cellular Association, came out and said that they did not think it was possible to sell a smartphone that cheaply, and they actually got the Indian government involved. They asked the telecom minister, Ravi Shankar Prasad, to intervene in this whole thing. It gets better. So they did like a little like press conference. They showcased a prototype, and they handed it out to media. But the media was not dumb, and they figured out that these were ADCOM devices that they just scratched out the branding on.
Oh, man.
Once Ring Bells got called on this, they circulated other prototypes, which were a completely different model. The phone looks like a Chinese phone where the original brand label was covered with like whiteout. The icons that were shown on the screen were direct copies of iPhone icons at the time.
Oh, no.
The MP of the Bharatiya Janata Party, I apologize, I'm probably pronouncing it terribly, described Ringing Bells as a Ponzi bogus company scam, and the government ended up raiding their offices.
Okay.
Yeah, the website has since gone idle, and Ringing Bells seems to be completely gone, but I love this, like, crazy, like, I don't know, we're watching Loki right now, and it's all this, like, weird, clandestine, mystery-like stuff, and I felt like this kind of fell into the same thing. So, there you go. So, that's my fact for 251, the smartphone, the world's cheapest smartphone.
That didn't actually exist.
That never actually existed. Maybe. Who knows?
Yeah.
The Freedom 251.
So, is this a phone the TVA uses?
You know what? I mean, they could go back to 2016, so
exactly.
Maybe. I don't know. We can have a little bit of Loki talk. How many episodes have you watched? We've watched the first two.
I watched all that is out so far.
You have all four of them, yeah.
Yeah.
I like two a lot more than one. One was literally the first Marvel episode of anything that actually put me to sleep.
I've already gotten enough hate for it online. I am not a huge fan. To me, it feels like Disney does Doctor Who. And Loki is my favorite character, Marvel character of all time, and it's just not doing it for me as much as I would hoped.
I mean, look, first of all, different strokes for different folks, right? Like, I mean, it's cool if you like it. It's cool if you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Can you say something?
Yeah, I don't dislike it. I just don't like it as much as I thought I would.
Okay, sure. I mean, that makes sense.
I'm kind of at the point where one or two more episodes and then I'm ready to pull the plug if I don't get more interested in it. Like, it's fine, but I have so many other things that I could use my time on to watch. So.
Like Deep Space Nine, which is the thing that we've been...
You know what? That's perfectly fine. Me and my wife just finished rewatching Deep Space Nine and started watching Voyager. We're on episode two.
Literally last night we were like, so what are we going to watch when we're done with Deep Space Nine? Because we're in season six, I think.
We're in season six.
Worf and Dax just got married. Spoiler alert.
Wait till you get to last season. That's quite the twist.
Yeah, but we agreed that we're watching Voyager after as well.
Yeah.
So
I'm trying really hard not to spoil the twists that come for Andrew.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah. I mean,
oh, he doesn't know.
Oh no, he doesn't know.
All right, I wasn't a Deep Space. So I was a Babylon 5 guy.
Fair.
So I'm enjoying watching Deep Space Nine, but like, I really you want to talk about getting hate? I really hate Avery Brooks as an actor. I cannot stand his acting. I mean, people like him, fine, but he drives me crazy. Like, Andrew Robinson is maybe my favorite actor on the show. He played Garrick. He was fantastic.
Yeah, Garrick is
I think he's oh. everybody's favorite.
Yeah. Maybe. I don't know.
Pretty close, yeah.
Well, I don't know. Alexander Siddig was obviously Nana Visitor's favorite.
Oh, boy.
Well, yeah, obviously.
Anyway, so we've gone far afield nerding out about stuff. But you know what? Honestly, Star Trek is a great thing, parents, that you can watch with your kids. It's really safe, and it's
nicely
pretty
PG.
Nerdy and pretty PG. Normally, at this point in the show, we talk about what we've been playing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Not what we've been watching.
Yes.
Maybe we can choose that segment
that.
Another time. But let's talk about what we've been playing. So, Mo, as always, we let our guest go first.
All right. So, the game I've got to the table the most often, which I think is worth talking about here, is a game called Flicking Finches. This is one I've been playing with my girls. So, this is the family gamers, right? So, I have two wonderful girls that I'm trying to mold into lifelong gamers, just like I was. So the game I've been playing with them lately is called Flicking Finches. It was designed by and features art by Yves Tournay. Right now, it only exists as a prototype, so I have a prototype copy. Meridae Games is hoping to get this published in 2022 through the help of Kickstarter.
Okay.
Now, a game of Flicking Finches takes about half an hour to play and plays 2 to 4 players. Now, this is a flicking-based dexterity game set in the Galapagos Islands. Players play a flock of finches who are flying around the islands trying to get the attention of Charles Darwin, hoping that they will get sketched into a sketchbook and be rewarded with seeds from Darwin. Now, the trick is, Darwin is studying evolution, and he's looking for finches with specific characteristics. These include size, beak design, and feather pattern. So you have 6 different finches, and you can evolve your finches, and you're flicking your finches, trying to get Darwin's attention, and the winner is the player controlling the flock that earns the most seeds. This is one of the most fun dexterity games I played that is completely family-friendly. I love the evolution theme. You don't see that very often, except in maybe a couple GMT-heavier games.
Mm-hmm.
And simple to play, easy to teach. My kids loved it. Really impressed by Flicking Finches.
So, I'm curious how the mechanics of this work. So it's a dexterity flicking game, so you're presumably flicking your finches somewhere, like at something?
Okay.
Or
so, quick summary of the game. You're going to put out a play mat that shows the Galapagos Islands. First player, you determine randomly, and then the second player is going to hatch a finch, and there's 3 nesting sites on the islands. You pick one of your finches, put it on the map, and give it 1 flick. Now, at this point, you don't have a target. This is just set up the board. The next player puts out 2 finches, the next player puts out 2 again, then it gets back to the first player, and they put the Darwin pawn out on one of the islands. Now, each of the observation spots Darwin's on have rings around them. So think of curling or crokinole or something where you're aiming for targets. Well, when you start your turn, you get 3 actions. First, you get to evolve a finch. So you can take one of your finches that's on the board and swap it for a finch in your reserve that has only 1 trait different. So like the beak size changes or it's a different size.
Okay.
Then you're going to flick, and you're trying to get within the rings around Darwin, and then use the chirp action for him to notice you. Now, if you hit Darwin, you dive-bombed him and scared him, and he moves to another side.
So you actually don't want to hit him.
Exactly. You don't want to hit him. You want to get close. And the other thing is he sketches the bird that's closest to him. So there's actually some strategy in there where if your opponents are actually closer to them, but they're birds that don't fit what he's looking for, you can chirp and he'll scratch them down anyway, and they'll get less points for it.
Oh, interesting.
So there is some actual strategy involved as well. There's an advanced set of rules where you put out wooden clouds that get in the way that you can kind of bounce off of and move. There's a lot of depth for what's really a simple game.
That sounds really neat.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good. So they're planning on going to Kickstarter in 2022?
They are going to Kickstarter later this year.
Okay.
I think in July. I don't have an exact date.
Mm-hmm.
And they're hoping to publish it by 2022.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. And what was the name of the publisher again?
Meridae, Meridae Games.
Very cool. All right. Well, we're going to have to keep our eye on that because that sounds really, really interesting.
There is a Board Game Geek page up for it if people want to check that out to get some stuff. And then I'll be publishing a review this weekend. So.
All right. Very cool.
All right.
we're coming up on the 4th of July, and we played the Independence Incident.
We did, yeah. And our review for this probably will have already come out when this podcast comes out, but the audio for that review is going to be in this show.
Yeah. I know by the time this show airs, we're past the 4th of July. However, if you're the kind of family that likes watching National Treasure or any of those, I would argue that this is not so tightly linked to the holiday that it has to be July 4th to play it.
Although, I mean, it worked out really well for us. We did the Independence Incident and we watched National Treasure all in the same week. So we're feeling very patriotic right now.
Or something.
But the Independence Incident, this is an 18-card escape room game in the Holiday Hijink series from Grand Gamers Guild. We talked about this a couple weeks ago when we had Jonathan Chaffer, who was a designer of that game, on the show. And it's really fun, and I liked it. So that's that. You know what? We played another game, and I want to talk about it because this game is gorgeous, called Subastral.
Oh, it was so pretty.
This is a game by Pinchback and Riddle, who are the guys who did Fleet the Dice Game, which is a game that we talk about all the time. Published by Renegade Games, and all of the art was done by Beth Sobel.
Which is why it's so pretty.
Subastral is a really interesting drafting set collection game.
Yeah, more set collection than drafting.
Well, but not drafting. What would that mechanic? I mean, you're picking up cards. I mean, it's drafting. You're picking up cards from a tableau.
I mean,
it's not. It's not like round robin drafting, like a Sushi Go or something like that. But all the cards are out there. You pick the ones you want. That's drafting.
I mean, kinda. You're always very limited in what you can actually manage to pick up, because what you can pick up is based on what card you played down to the big central tableau. It's got this really weird push and pull feel. Every time you play a card, you can decide to take cards from one side of that to add to your hand, or take some cards from the other side of it to put into your scoring tableau.
Right. So the premise of the game is all the point scoring is from set collection at the end of the game. But what you're doing is you start with three cards in your hand, and the cards have numbers on them. When you play a card into the tableau, which is just ranks from 1 to 6, when you play a card out, anything less than that, you can take one of the piles in one of the ranks less than it, and those cards will go into your hand. You could take one of the piles of the ranks greater than that one, and those have to go into your tableau. So if I play a 4, I can either pick up all the cards in the 1, 2, or 3 rank, and they go into my hand. Or I can pick up the cards in the 5 or the 6 rank, and they go into my scoring tableau.
So how do you get cards out of your hand, then?
You can only get them out of your hand by playing them to this central area.
By playing them into this central thing.
Okay.
So like you can sequence these. So like if you've got a card in your hand that you want in your tableau, you can play it down somewhere so that later you play a lower ranked card so that you pick up that higher rank thing later.
If somebody else doesn't get it.
If somebody else hasn't already taken it, you know.
And
then there's things like if you play on the 6, you can take the 1 and put it in your tableau or if whatever. And there's mild perks for doing that kind of thing. So mechanically, like the game's not really that complicated, but it is just so wonderful to look at. And it's got this very, like, I don't want to say zen because there's no Japanese theme here, but it's very laid back. It's a nice end of the night game. It's not, I don't know if I would call it a filler game. It doesn't feel like a filler game to me, but it does feel like an end of the night kind of relaxing game.
Well, and it's got this push-pull mechanic of trying to figure out the right cards to get, because as I learned when I picked up a whole stack of 2s, that didn't do me very good because the only place I could play them was on the 2.
On the 2s.
But the decisions you have to make about the numbers are sufficiently interesting without feeling high stakes. You know, and I think that's part of what adds to, like, it doesn't feel like there's a lot of tension or stress, but the decisions are interesting.
So we've only played this at 2 players. I think the game's going to change a lot if you go to a higher player count, because at 2 players, you can say, well, I can play this here because based on what, you know, the other person has in their tableau, I have a feeling they're going to want to do this kind of thing. But when you've got 3 other players, you can't do that. You know, that you don't have that flexibility anymore. And so it becomes a lot harder to predict or try to predict what other people are doing. So I think it's going to change the game a lot when we play it.
It'll become more of a game of, this is what's in front of me. What's a good decision I can make?
How good can you, how well can you react to what you have?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's Subastral from Renegade Games. That's a game that's on our review queue. We just got it in this past week. Oh, when I pulled it out of the, when I opened that box, I was like, oh, because it's just so pretty. It's so pretty.
So speaking of games and playing two players and playing different, the other game I've been playing this week is a game called Guildmaster. This is designed by Chris Anthony, featuring art by Andrew Bosley, Alexander Mihalovic, and Yumadu Daniel Orchi. Published by Good Games Publishing 2020. Plays 3 to 4 players, despite what it says on the box. Now, the box does claim you can play it with 2 players, and that's the issue I found with this game. Games usually take about 2 hours. Now, this is a fantasy-themed board game with an RPG twist. You are taking on the role of an adventuring guild, the kind of thing where your Dungeons & Dragons characters would hook up with other characters and go on an adventure. You run the guild in this game. You hire heroes, send hero teams out to complete missions, and work to upgrade your guild, with the player with the most fame winning the game. Now, I did receive a review copy of this from Good Games Publishing, and it's on our queue to do, but right now, due to the lockdowns, I'm stuck playing with my wife most of the time, and this one's a little too advanced for my kids at this point. So we're stuck with only 2 players on this one, and we finally decided to give it a try, because I've had this game for a while. And we sat down to play this, and I had a feeling it wasn't going to go very well, and unfortunately it didn't, because it features a number of mechanics that really don't work well with 2 players. First off, when you go to hire heroes, it's an auction. And auctions with 2 players is you win or lose. There's no competition there. Yeah. And money's open. Now, at least if money was hidden, you could maybe fiddle it a bit. There'd be bluffing involved, but money's open. So that's gone. Second, when 2 players both try to attempt the same mission, there's this really cool, almost role-playing bit where you decide if you're going to work together and how you're going to work together and how you're going to split the spoils. That leads to a prisoner's dilemma mechanic, where people then put out a token, green, you work together, red, you fight. Again, 2 players, prisoner's dilemma. It just doesn't really work.
Right.
There is no reason to ever work together if you're in the lead. Then the completed missions are all take that. So when you complete a mission, it's like take 2 gold or take 3 gold away from another guild. Again, with 2 players, you're always just penalizing the other player in last.
Mm-hmm.
So neat game, looks fantastic. I have a feeling I'm going to love it at 3 to 4 players. But I got to admit, I'm always disappointed when publishers put a number on the box that really doesn't work. This should not say 2 player on the box at all. It should be a 3 to 4 player game, in my opinion.
That makes a lot of sense. We've run into this. Like, a perfect example of that for us was Tidal Blades. Like, Tidal Blades have a lot of fun playing this game at 3 players, but at 2 players, there's like this automa thing, and it's just complicated and obnoxious. And it just was, I didn't like it at all. It's same kind of thing. I totally agree.
It's not unworkable, but it adds so much more complexity.
Right.
It's just not worth it.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. Now, I don't know what's worth. A game that shouldn't be played at 2 players or a game where they have to modify the rules to play at 2 players.
I'm not
a fan of either. I prefer games that just work at 2 players or all player counts.
So let's also talk about Andor, the family fantasy game, since we're just talking about fantasy and...
Ooh.
At least light role-playing in our case.
Yeah, have you played this one at all? Have you seen this?
I'm really curious about this because I love Andor. Legends of Andor is one of my favorite games. It's like a role-playing puzzle. I don't know. It's such a unique game. It seems like a dice-chucking adventure game, but then you sit down to play and it's a big puzzle. And I'm really curious to hear about the family version.
So it's not so much a puzzle here, but did you ever play Adventureland from Haba?
Unfortunately, no. I have heard really good things, but it's not one I have had a chance to check out.
I mean, we'll make a quick comparison anyway, which is to say, we found that the Andor family fantasy game felt a little bit more engaging and like the missions meant something versus Adventureland. Yes, you're adventuring and you're collecting stuff and that's great and everybody kind of gets to the end of the board and then the game's over.
Yeah,
you're just collecting stuff.
So in the way Andor works is it's a collaborative game, and there's kind of like a start card, an end card, and a certain number of tasks in the middle. And these tasks, in the one we did the starting mission, right? And so in the starting mission, there's 2 tasks. One of them is you have to go basically to the other side of the board, get the Falcon, and then bring the Falcon back to Rietburg. And they'll take care of the Falcon there. And, you know, there's a bunch of restrictions. You can't go into areas with fog tokens. You can't go into areas that, you know, have creatures and all this other stuff. So there's kind of it's like a movement challenge, right? But it's straightforward. It's not complicated because this is a game for a family.
But you're also clearing a path and you're taking your chance at the things that you find as you're clearing a path. They could be good, they could be neutral, they could be really bad.
Right. Now, are those set by the scenario or randomized?
So the board is covered with these fog tokens, which are all face down.
Yep.
So you kind of
shuffle those up.
So it's randomized. Okay, cool.
And that's that. You do that at the beginning of the game, regardless of what tasks you're taking out or anything. So it's entirely that part is entirely randomized. And so in the starting thing that we did, the other task was that you had to get into the mine and recover the three like wolf cubs. So in order to get into the mine, you had to travel to all these bush tokens all over the board. And you had to have one of your adventurers across your party who had two matching flowers from these bushes. And those bush tokens, again, all randomized. So you might go to two bushes and, hey, you know, they match and you're good to go. You might not. Mm-hmm. You bring those matching flowers to the dwarf who is guarding the bridge to the mine. That clears the dwarf out of the way. Then you go into the mine and you have to search in the mine. The primary mechanic in this game with fighting or with searching in the mine is rolling your dice. And there's, I don't want to say asynchronous player powers, but the dice are weighted differently depending on which player you are. So I played as the dwarf. Okay. I had more torches on my dice than any other symbol, which meant I was better at searching in the mine than anyone else. Because unlike fog tokens or bush tokens, where if you go there, you flip it over and see what it is, in the mine, if you go somewhere, in order to flip that mine token over, you have to roll your dice and get a torch. If you don't get a torch, you don't get to flip it over.
You're in the dark. You can't see what's there.
Right, right,
yeah.
Right. So this whole time, everybody has these things they call sun discs, which is basically how many moves you have per round. And you can move really far and burn one sun disc for every movement and do that once and then, like, you're done. Or you can, you know, kind of plod along slowly, and that's fine. I think our middle son, who played with us, he had, like, 14 sun discs, and I had, like, 8. So it's, again, dependent on the characters. So everybody's kind of going around, and you're all talking above the board, discussing, like, oh, you should go over here, I can take advantage of this, blah, 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 blah. You can go to, what are the things, gores? Is that what the enemy? The
gores
orc,
were the,
orc,
the enemy.
The
and don't
thing?
Forget the dragon.
Oh, I haven't forgotten the dragon. I haven't gotten to the dragon yet. So there's 8 spots on the board for these things called gores. And every round you add more gores to the board. And they always start at 8. And then they, you know, if 8 is filled, then you go to 7, 6, blah, blah, blah. And also at the end of the round, the gores move one space. So the thing that was on 8 goes to 7. The thing that was on 7 goes to 6, 5, blah, blah, blah. If you have a gore on 1 and it moves, it goes into Rietburg. And if that happens, the dragon moves closer to Rietburg. So the dragon functions basically as a timer for the game. If the dragon gets to Rietburg, you have lost.
And there's all sorts of other things that are like, oh, by the way, you need to roll the dragon die an extra time or things. So you're always trying to fight the gores because every time you defeat a gore, the dragon moves back one space. It's this back and forth.
Yeah, but there's also like, there's a watchtower. If you flip over a fog token and get some lumber, you can go to the watchtower and light one of the fires in the watchtower, and that will move the dragon back. So there's this constant push and pull. It's not complicated. It's very easy to understand. Our 7-year-old didn't play with us, but he would have no problem understanding this game. But there's a lot of, I don't want to say point salad because you're not scoring points, but it's that kind of thing where there's
a lot of different things
going on, and you can talk them out and say, like, well, the dragon's getting closer. Do you think we should try to beat some gores so that we can knock that back, or do you think we should try to do some other things? Anitra played as the magician.
Yeah.
I don't know. And the magician, instead of having 3 dice, has 1 die, but the die has a lightning bolt on it. So,
which is like an insta kill. Yeah.
So the gores, if the half of the gore spaces are rock spaces and half of them are forest spaces, if a gore is on a rock space, it takes 3 battle icons to kill them. If they're on a forest space, it takes 2. But if you're the magician, and it's very simple. I know this sounds complicated. It's really not. But if you're the magician, all you have to do is roll the lightning bolt and you're all set. So Anitra's character would be going to the gores on the rocks because they're the harder ones to kill. And she's like, boom, you're dead. Boom, you're dead. And so that would kind of push the dragon back and fight the dragon back. And as the dwarf, I was able to use the mine, there's like little shortcuts that only dwarves can use. And I was the one who went to the mine and did all the mine searching because I have the best torch and all this other stuff like that. So it was really easy for us to talk about who should do what and what makes the most sense. And even though there's a lot going on the board, it's really simple to understand. It's very simple.
I think it was really intuitive. I would say that this is something where you're generally going to want a parent or a much older sibling to do the setup, just because there's a lot involved with the setup. But the actual gameplay, once you understand the rules for your particular scenario, you are off and running.
Yep, and the linking of these tasks together, I mean, there's not really a narrative to it, but it kind of feels like there is one. Certainly more so than Adventureland. In Adventureland, the cool thing about that is the special movement mechanics, and then the different tasks were just kind of like, well, the movement mechanics are cool, so we might as well have you do something with them.
Yeah.
You know, these are the tasks that you have to complete. So it was really, really fun. And there's like there's probably a stack of like 15 different task cards, maybe 20. Yeah. So you can mix that up for sure. I would even say, I know when you said you need a parent to, maybe the first couple times, if you have a kid that is old enough to read, they can set this game up once they kind of know what's going on. There's a nice end of round, like, these are the 7 things you do, kind of like player aid, which is really helpful. So you just kind of walk through that and it really helps you so you don't forget anything. So they did an excellent job capturing this adventuring feel and making it something that like 7 to 12 year olds can play and have fun with, I think.
Yeah, right? I think so.
Yeah.
So do you have to play with all the characters, with each character being specialized and needed for different things?
No.
Do you have to have everyone?
No. It makes it easier.
Yeah,
we played
with 3
out of the 4. Right. I do think it makes certain things easier. But I don't think it's necessary. It's required or anything like that.
No.
So you definitely don't have to do all the things, even though there's lots of different things to do.
And, well, so there are various tasks that you'll have to do to be able to win the game. And that some of that is determined by the task cards you pull. But also, everybody can do all of the things. It's just that some people are better at some things than others.
Yeah, and in this example, so if we didn't have the magician, we would just defeat the Gores when they were in the forest and let them move off of the rocks into the forest and defeat them in the forest again. Like, we would have to change our strategy based on the characters that we had, which I think is a really good developmental thing for, you know, burgeoning board gamers, because they're going to have to say, well, these are the strengths and the weaknesses, and we can kind of work with this. But I mean, we only played it the one time, but everything in this game says this is approachable. Everybody's going to understand this. It's going to make a lot of sense. And I'm definitely eager to play it a lot more.
Yeah, me too.
Yep.
Sounds really solid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lots of fun.
In the spirit of adventuring, I would also like to mention Zombie Kids Evolution, which has been getting some more play.
Are you trying to catch up to me on the BG Stats thing where I have like a bunch of players?
I don't know if I'm going to catch up to you. And I've still only played it at 2 players, whereas everybody else is like, oh yeah, we've played it at 3 players, we've played it at 4 players. I'm like, oh, that's nice. I'll just keep finding one person to play it with me at a time.
Well, that's real life. We're busy.
It is. But this game is addictive. I am not surprised that we played it twice and our son was like, can we play it again? Come on, we'll open another envelope. And I was like, no, stop. We'll play again tomorrow.
Yeah, it really has that, ooh, just one more time teaser thing, just pulling on you, pulling on you, pulling on you. And our kids don't know this, but we picked up a copy of Zombie Teens Evolution.
Yeah. We'll be ready when we
lots of Scorpion Mask in our future.
Yeah.
So Mo, you're nodding like you've played Zombie Kids?
No.
Really?
Oh,
you
gotta
pick this
up.
You gotta check this one out. It's super, super approachable. So very, very easy. Very short play. Like, you play through a game in 15 minutes. 15 minutes.
This is a legacy game with kids explicitly in mind. It is the first one I have seen like that.
I mean, I think My City had family weight and kids.
Yes, there are family weight legacy games. This one explicitly has children in mind because it is short. There is very limited reading in learning the rules, and then there's basically no reading after that. The rules are super approachable. I mean, there's no like, do I kill this guy or not? It's I move in. Oh, look, the zombies in my room are now dead. Done. So it's really nice at how simple it is to get into it, but don't mistake simple for easy.
Right. It's always a good thing.
Right.
Some of the best games. Easy to learn, difficult to master.
Yep, absolutely.
And because it's a legacy game, some of the points and achievements to open up new envelopes is driven by not just playing the game a bunch, but also looking to get specific achievements to give you extra little stickers and move you along the track faster. So our kids have been very motivated to be like, let's try playing it this way. Let's try playing it this other way. Let's try to go for this goal. And that also helps keep changing it up a little bit so that you're like, okay, well, we can definitely beat it this way now, but we can't open new envelopes yet. Maybe we can try this other thing that's going to be a little bit harder to work around.
You know, one thing I actually like about ZKE also is that it allows you to do the grind thing that you normally see in video games.
Yes.
Okay.
Because if you just play a game of it, you get to put a brain sticker on the progress track.
Yeah.
Whether you win or not. If you win, you put two on. And so if you're looking at it and you're like, all right, well, I can't figure out how to play it like this, but maybe there's something in the next envelope that will help, you can just play games of Zombie Kids and make no, you know, narrative progress, but you're still playing the game, you're still having fun playing the game, you're still being successful, and you're doing the grind thing that anybody who has ever played a JRPG knows exactly what I'm talking
about.
I
may not have won this, but I'm still getting better at it, and I have this visual symbol that I'm getting better at.
I mean, there is some die rolling in this game, so it's not all getting better at. There's some luck involved.
I'm well aware. We lost our last game because of a die roll.
But it's still fun. And again, you know, it's you can set it up in 2 minutes. You can play a game in 10 to 15.
Yep.
You can close it up. I mean, 20 minutes, you're in and out of that game. So that's pretty awesome.
And that's specifically the Evolution Edition.
Yes.
Is there a regular
Zombie
Kids?
There is a regular Zombie Kids. It's about 10 years old now.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Zombie Kids Evolution. That's the one that we're talking about. Okay. From Scorpion Mask. I don't know how much it is in Canada. It's like $25 US.
Nice.
I can't imagine it's much more than that if you can get it.
That's always a problem. All the time.
I have one more game. Claire was begging anyone to play Tussie Mussie with her. And so being the loving and wonderful and amazing father that I am.
Yes, you are.
I agreed to play Tussie Mussie. It helps that it's a great game.
Yes,
and
sure.
She wrecked me.
Which, she knows how you tick.
Yeah, well, that's fine. So, anyway, and that's it. That's all I've played.
Well, so a lot of this is because Claire is very achievement focused. So she's working through that game school summer like achievement list. And so she also asked me to play a game from my childhood. And she's like, I don't know, what kind of games did you have as a kid, Mom? Like, chess? Thanks, honey.
Yeah.
But we pulled out my copy of Troke, which is a game that almost nobody has heard of. It was published in the 1960s, but it is a kind of Chinese checkers-esque. You're trying to get all your pieces to the other end of the board, but each piece is actually three pieces. They call it castle checkers. So there's a moat and a wall and a tower. And they're very abstract. It's all smooth plastic. But for me, it's this really fun nostalgia trip of, you know, you're moving towards your goal, but you can also capture other people and move them towards your goal and away from theirs. And we were pretty well balanced because I won the first time and she won the second time.
There
so
you go.
It was good.
You'd think you'd have more experience with this.
You would think. You would be wrong.
Looking at it, it reminds me of the games in the GIF series.
Yeah.
It really looks like that style of game.
Yeah, I did not find out till I was an adult that it obviously went through some evolution and changes over the course of a decade or so, because the copy that I had grown up with had a few different rules than the copy that Andrew found me when we were newlyweds.
Interesting.
And then my parents found their copy and they're like, oh, hey, do you want this? So I was like, yes, because that's the one with the rules, I understand.
All right, well, why don't we do this? We'll take a quick break. When we come back, Mo, we have so many questions about what it's like to be the classiest tabletop content creator out there.
Oh, I don't know if I qualify for that one. It's just a fancy title.
It works. All right, we'll be right back.
It's nearly the 4th of July, so naturally you head to the American History Museum. But things aren't quite as they seem? Can you solve the mystery?
This is a snap review for The Independence Incident. The Independence Incident is an 18-card mini escape room created by Jonathan Schaffer and published by Grand Gamers Guild. It took us, a gaming family, about 45 minutes to complete it.
So, The Independence Incident is the next game in the Holiday Hijinks series, and it's similar to the Kringle Caper, which is the game that came before it. It was a Christmas-themed game, and it came out last holiday season. We previously reviewed that at thefamilygamers.com. We'll leave you to find it.
The art in the Independence Incident is thematically similar to the Kringle Caper, no surprise, with Jonathan Chaffer and Josh Capel doing the art and the graphic design again. As with the Kringle Caper, the team did a great job using every single square centimeter of the cards to pack them full of information on all sides.
Personally, I liked some of the graphics used in the Independence Incident a little bit better. I felt like they pulled me into the story a little bit more.
I agree. I liked this art just a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. So, Anitra, let's talk about the mechanics in the Independence Incident.
Like Jonathan said when he was on the Family Gamers podcast, there's so little material in this package. It's literally 18 cards and a sleeve.
That's it.
That some of the scaffolding of the game needs to come from an app. Grand Gamers Guild has a website that works like an app that you can log into from your mobile device, or non-mobile device if you prefer. There's a QR code on the inside flap that you can use to get there quickly. Log in, then flip over card number one.
Trust us when we say this, you're going to need a pen and paper. You might want a pen and paper for each person when you're playing this. You also will probably need some hints from the website, or when you encounter various puzzles, you may want some reference material on hand. Now, I'm not going to share what that is. Again, I'll let you find that out for yourself.
There is a lot of reference materials on the website as well. Of course, they're going to give you much more references than you actually need to play the game.
So, Anitra, what did we expect from the Independent Incident?
Well, we really enjoyed the Kringle Caper, which was the first entry in the Holiday Hijinks series.
I was really excited for this one. I have a lot more interest in American history than I do in, like, Christmas stories. So, I was kind of ready for random U.S. history trivia, especially with our homeschool helper, Asher, who has been learning some American history. This also encouraged us to watch a movie that, you know, maybe helps you take a look at Charlotte and see if the secret lies with her.
For me, I expected a similar kind of puzzles to what we had seen in the Kringle Caper, and I expected there to be really clever card use, just like we had seen before.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about what surprised us in the Independence Incident.
Well, I was surprised to find out that I actually found this one a little bit easier. If you look at the back, it says right here, difficulty 3 out of 3.
You found it easier? I thought it was a little bit harder.
Well, I mean, maybe it was the theme. Like I said before, I really like the theme, so it just kind of worked better for me. I also felt like there was a noticeable quality difference between the two of them. To me, the Independence Incident had more interesting puzzles to it. The knowledge you needed to bring to the puzzles was kind of more mechanical, like systems that you needed to understand, instead of just trivia knowledge, which is almost kind of what you needed in some of the stuff in the Kringle Caper. But maybe, again, it was the theme, the fact that it was real history and not Christmas stories. Maybe that's what helped me along.
Well, I felt like there should have been more trivia. Sometimes I look too deeply for hidden meanings in what we were given. And there were several puzzles that, to be fair, our kids didn't understand at all until you and I figured them out and then explained them.
We definitely recommend the Independence Incident. For $10 for this package,
or $5 for the print and play,
you get about an hour of entertainment for your family. So, Anitra, what do you think we'll rate the Independence Incident from Grand Gamers Guild?
I think we should give it 4.5 out of 5 fireworks.
Okay. And that's the Independence Incident
in a snap.
Back. So we're here with Mo, the tabletop bellhop, and we are super excited.
Well, I'm excited that Mo is on the show because, Mo, you do like a lot of stuff that, actually, I would say the most often I see your posts on social media, they're about deals that are out there.
Well, yeah, there is that. That's almost like...
It's a service, though. Like, I mean, that's what I see the most often. You have tons and tons of resources at your website.
Yeah, so one of the things we do, I do it under Tabletop Gaming Deals. That's what keeps us alive. That's the day job. That's what pays the bills. Mm-hmm. That's what lets us do the show. That's what lets me work from home and talk about games all the time, pretty much full time. Mm-hmm. So that's a part of it, that one of the concierge services, I guess we can say. But I do usually kind of distance it. While that is on the website and there are links to the deals, that's not really our main drive. That's not our mission statement. That's what we have to do now to make this viable.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I completely understand that. Well, How about this? Talk about yourself a little bit. So you kind of mentioned gaming with your family a little bit. Sometimes you, we see pictures of you sharing, like, families playing games or your family playing games. What does a family game night look like in the Two Signal household?
All right, so I am a lifelong gamer. Like, people always have those, when did you start playing games? And I'm like, one of my earliest memories is sitting on my dad's lap and him painting Dungeons & Dragons miniatures.
Oh, wow.
We've just always had games in our house. Like, growing up, my dad was a board game collector. He had collected Sports Illustrated bookshelf games and Avalon Hill and Sid Saxon. And at the time, he had a shelfie. He had over 100 games, which in the 70s was a big deal.
Right.
Yeah.
That just didn't happen then. So my dad was an avid gamer and he passed that on to me. And what I'm trying to do is do the same for my kids. Now, if my dad was able to see it and he saw my basement right now, it is a huge room with over 1,000 board games in it and an 8x4 board game table in the center of it. And that is what we play games on.
That's awesome.
So game nights here in the Tuzno household involve going downstairs to the game room, which when we bought the house was a pool room. So we pulled the pool table out and then put bookshelves all around all the walls. And then, pro tip, instead of buying a board game table, pick up a board room table. They are way cheaper than your standard wooden kitchen tables or things like that, or some of the fancy board game tables. Though I admit they don't have the backlighting and USB ports and all the stuff you might get off at some of the fancy tables. But if you're looking to get a game room table on a budget, board room tables are the way to go. So I have an 8x4 board room table filled with shelves around covered in games. And game night involves myself, one or more of my kids. I have two wonderful daughters that I game with, or my wife. All are avid gamers. I married my wife. I met her running a game of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay on a BBS back
in
the day.
Wow, so, that's awesome.
that we're going classic there. My girls are also very involved with the schools. They both help out at the school's board gaming club, and they're both certified game teachers for the teachers, and they help teach games, and just got their school to swap over to playing on Board Game Arena this year. So we're working as hard as we can to make lifelong gamers out of
it. Wow, that is awesome. I yield to your board game rearing skills, sir. That's some awesome stuff. So, okay. So let's focus on the tabletop bellhop for a minute. So, how long ago did you start? I think maybe about 3 years ago. That's
2019
was my guess.
Yeah, it's around there. The idea has been about 5 years old. Uh-huh. So the way I've been talking about games online since 2002. That originally started with trying to get more people gaming out. Now, I mentioned about my dad being a lifelong gamer. One of the problems my dad had was finding other people to play with, especially at that time period. Mm-hmm. In general, he had one other family that he would play with that they would get together a few times a year and game together. And I didn't want that to happen to me or any of the other local gamers. So I founded something called the Windsor Gaming Resource. Again, I'm from Windsor, Ontario, Canada. And that was a forum for people to meet up and play games. From that, we started meeting up, and I started hosting game nights. So in 2002, I started hosting game nights, and I published my first review on the Pro Boards free forum for the Windsor Gaming Resource in 2003. So I've been talking about games online for a long time. Now, my best friend from grade school, I was in grade one, he was in kindergarten, is Sean Stevens. I gamed with for a bit, then he moved away and went to university in Toronto and never came back to Windsor. Meanwhile, I went my own way down here getting into the automotive industry. And we reconnected about 5 years ago, and he was super into podcasts, like really into them when they first started, like mainly with the Kevin Smith stuff that started coming out, the Smodcast being one of the big ones, and then moving on to mostly tech ones. And he has been telling me since listening to his first episode of the Smodcast, we need to do a podcast. You know way too much about games. We need to get you on, and I need to interview you about games. And I was like, I got my Windsor Gaming Resource. I got Pro Boards. I share my reviews here. Oh, look, I discovered this site called Board Game Geek. Now I'm sharing stuff there. I don't need to do a podcast. And Sean just kept bugging me and bugging me and bugging me.
I'm getting nasty looks from Anitra right now.
This story sounds very familiar, except I live with the person who was bugging me constantly about being on a podcast.
There you go. So,
would have been a lot harder to say no then, huh?
Yeah, it would have been. So what ended up happening is I had a long-time job in the auto industry. I was in quality, ISO standards, all really boring, mundane stuff. And they downsized. The biggest hiring place in Windsor, Ontario is the Windsor Assembly Plant for Chrysler, and they got rid of the third shift, and they downsized, and I was part of that downsizing. Right around the same time was Breakout Con, which is a fantastic gaming convention in Toronto, Ontario. and Sean lives in Toronto, so we hooked up to go to BreakoutCon. And this was actually, I actually got to go as press because I have social media accounts. Again, still we're on Windsor Gaming. I haven't started Tabletop Bellhop yet. And we sat down with Sean, and Sean's like, all right, you don't have a job now. You've got a really good severance that lasts over a year and a half, and said, now's our chance. Let's do it. And I'm like, okay, let's do this. And I had come up, and I couldn't tell you exactly when, I came up with the concept of Tabletop Bellhop. So I got the idea from the Happy Jacks RPG podcast. At this point, Sean got me into podcasts. I subbed to over 200 podcasts. That's a lot. I'm 400 episodes behind right now. But anyway, I'm listening to Happy Jacks, and they are a mail-in show. People mail in and ask RPG questions. And I'm like, how come no one's doing this for board games? They call in and they do their, you know, Wednesday night, what they do the whole Sleepless in Seattle. I showed up to a game convention. The DM was horrible. Here's what happened. What should I have done? Right? Those kind of questions. I'm like, no one's doing this for board gaming. That'd be a niche that no one's doing. Mm-hmm. And I honestly have no idea where Tabletop Bellhop, your cardboard concierge, came from. But wherever it came from, I thank myself because I love the way that sounds. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, that is a good name. I have branding right with that name. So Sean, myself, and Deanna sat down. We were at a Duke pub in Toronto, Ontario. Eating dinner at middle of Breakout Con, and we sealed the deal. We decided we're going to do it. Now, Sean has been begging me to do a podcast. I said, you know what? There's this thing called Critical Role. 3 million people a week are watching people play D&D. This blows my mind.
Right.
Plus, there's people cosplaying as other people's D&D characters. This is bananas. We need to take advantage of this. So I'll tell you what. I will do a podcast, but we are going to record it live on Twitch, and we're going to be famous. Now, if you tune into any of my Twitch streams, you'll realize we don't get any 3 million views, but that was my contribution, is we're going to be the Tabletop Bellhop, we're going to record a podcast, but we're also going to do it on Twitch. Then Deanna pointed out, now Deanna is a Canadian mommy blogger, so she has all the experience on the webpage side of things and getting the webpage promoted. She's like, oh yeah, if you do those, you're also going to make a blog. And then we came up with the concept that the best part about this is people will be able to consume our content however they wish. So they can watch it, they can listen to it, or they can read it. And that became one of the founding principles, is we are going to try to put out our content all three ways. And the other theory was if we're going to record it anyway, why not do it live? So we do a lot of stuff live just because. Mm-hmm. And part of that has grown into a great community of people who join us for almost every live show and we interact with on the show. And we get a lot of personal touch to the people who join us live, which I really like. And that was ridiculously long. I don't know.
I find it
fascinating. I mean, it's interesting because we have a lot of parallels in there. Like the concept of hitting all of the media streams. Like we're now doing video stuff. But the reason why we got into the Snap Reviews 2+ years ago was
almost 3 years ago
was to do audio reviews on top of the written reviews, and so now we're pushing those into video so that we can do the same thing there. So I track with a lot of that. I think you've got your Andor the Family Fantasy characters with their asymmetric player powers with a blogger and a podcaster and all this stuff.
Yep.
So you know, I mean, all those pieces are coming together. I think it's awesome, and I really do appreciate the niche that you fit yourself into, because there's a lot of board game reviewers, and honestly, like, you guys do board game reviews, but that's not like, that's not your A game. That's not, you know, the primary thing that you're really trying to hit.
No, like I said, as I said at the start of the show, when I introduced myself, we're here to answer your gaming and game night questions and make everyone's gaming experience better. We want to be a Dear Abby for gamers. We want people to write to us with our questions and let me put my years of game playing, event organizing, and game night hosting to use for the rest of the community. Mm-hmm. I have been doing this my whole life. Mm-hmm. Like, I have been playing games and playing games with other people. When things are normal, I run events at local game stores, cafes, comic shops, and bars. Almost every Saturday, I host local events. I know how to teach games, and I try to impart that knowledge to other people. I want to share my love for the hobby, and I want to be an ambassador for this hobby. I think it's a wonderful hobby. Now, I know you're mainly a board game focused podcast. We say tabletop because I'm also all about the role-playing games. So I definitely do both. Anything you can sit down with your friends at a table and play, I'm all for it.
Yeah, our kids are getting there. I think they're interested in RPGs. Our daughter has started reading our D&D books.
Right.
So she's definitely interested. I think we're going to start out with some smaller stuff. We just got the Goonies game from Funko, and that's kind of a heavily themed RPG, and I guess odds are I'm going to be the DM for that one. This is how it's going to work.
Probably.
So it's definitely coming in our future, as a family, it's a little bit harder to get into some of that stuff.
Yeah.
They're probably, like, I know No Thank You Evil is an RPG. We have basically the entire Hero Kids collection, so that's kind of an RPG as well that we want to get into. So we're certainly also fans of RPGs. It's just not something that we tend to cover all that much.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah, for my kids, I started them off with a game called Mermaid Adventures from Aloyla Santa from Third Eye Games, which was a game about playing mermaids. From there, we moved to Tales of Equestria, which is My Little Pony role-playing game. And most recently, we are obsessed with Magical Kitties Save the Day. This is from Atlas Games, where you play magical cats trying to solve your humans' problems. I personally think for kids, this is a way better game than Dungeons & Dragons or any other beat-up-the-bad-guys-to-get-XP to get tougher to beat up more bad guys games.
Uh-huh.
I strongly recommend that if you get a chance to check it out.
Magical Kitties.
Magical Kitties Save the Day. There's a review at Tabletop.
And we'll link to it in the show notes for this episode.
Awesome. So. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to look that one up. My interest is piqued, we shall say.
All right, so I want to dig just a little bit more, because we already talked about you started with the podcast and doing it live, and then you're like, you've also included doing reviews, mostly written, but sometimes, you know, worked into your videos and such.
So every episode, we review at least one game, sometimes two. The review is we do it live on our podcast Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern. We record that, then that gets edited down and cut from the podcast and released on YouTube Video On Demand, VOD. Now, these reviews is talking heads. It's Sean and I, you see our faces, talking about the game. For the edited version, Sean does put up images, pictures I've taken, showing off the components. Mm-hmm. But it's not like a walkthrough, not like your usual review where it kind of shows you all the fancy graphics and they look all pretty. This is more a couple of guys talking about the games they played with some graphics to show it off. So every single review does go out up on YouTube. Then that weekend, I will write up a written version of the review. So that'll get released on the blog. Then on Tuesdays, the full episode of the podcast comes out, which then is, again, further edited. Not to the extent you guys edit your show, but definitely further edited compared to what you would see live. It is definitely edited down. So every review is released, again, live show, then on YouTube, then on the blog. So it is all three formats. And like I said, we try to do one a week at least, possibly two, depending on how long they are and what they are. What I like about our review format is we don't do the new hotness. We're most reviewers out there are talking about the brand new games that are coming out. And yes, we do some, but mostly it's games we're excited about. We try to limit it to games. Like, I don't accept review copies of something that doesn't interest me at all. I have to be really excited before I'll say yes. And a lot of the games, I wouldn't say a lot. Some of the games, I also talk about games that I purchased myself. I talk a lot about that. We just reviewed Space Base. That's my game. I bought that game. We're not working with AEG. That's just something I wanted to share with the world because, wow, I think everyone knows it's good, but now I tried it and I know it's good.
So I'm going to ask this quick question just in here. Replace Machi Koro with Space Base?
Oh, so I could just say, go to the review, because I actually took the section and I compared it to Valeria, Card Kingdoms, and Machi Koro.
Okay, so I have a copy of Valeria, because that theme appealed to me a little bit more than Space Base, and I thought it might be a little simpler for the kids.
I would say Space Base is simpler.
See, it just seems like there was a lot more pieces in the Space Base box, so I really had nothing to go on for that.
So of the three, I prefer Valeria right now. Space Base is really close. And I am not a fan of Machi Koro at all.
Okay. Yeah, see, I find Machi Koro, once you add the Harbor expansion in so you can randomize the market, makes it a much better game. But it does replaced by the VCK.
So the Machi Koro I played is the Bright Lights Big City, which combines supposedly the best cards from Harbor and Millionaire's Row and puts it in one box.
Yep.
And I just found it way too chaotic. Money was passing around like crazy. The credits were passing around like crazy. Mm. And it was way too much take that. You're like, I'm finally trying to save up for this big thing. And then someone steals half my money.
Yes.
Oh, I'm about to get this. And then someone takes my money. Oh, I'm about to do this. And then someone plays that purple card that hurts everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found it too chaotic and too much take that. Valeria I love as a fantasy gamer. I love the feel of hiring adventurers and going to kill monsters in a dungeon and eventually forming a stronghold. That gives me roots to old school D&D to me, especially the stronghold part at the end of your adventure. Space Base is really good, though. And I have a feeling, and I haven't done it, I owned it, I've put up an unboxing video, is I think Shy Pluto might put it above Valeria, but I don't know yet. I'm actually hoping to get that to the table this weekend.
See, the biggest thing that scares me about Valeria is there's so many expansions that if I let myself peer over the abyss, I think you know where I'm going.
I own all of those. I do not work with Daily Magic games. I own all of those.
Yeah, that's a problem. Like, I don't... I have enough restraint to keep myself from going over the edge, but, like, I have the Smash Up Big Geeky box for a reason.
Yep.
So I'm a little afraid of that. Yeah. And so, yeah, anyway, thank you for answering my question.
No problem.
Tabletop Bellhop, I appreciate that. All right, one last question, and then I think we're going to wrap this up.
All right.
You talked a lot about the community and about how much you love this hobby. What are some of your favorite things about the board game hobby and the greater community of gamers?
That's a little bit harder. The joy on someone's face. So one of my favorite things is to, I hate using the term converts, maybe that's not the right term, but waking up someone's eyes to just what is out there in the board game community, just how much variety there is, especially when you've got a gamer who just grew up on your traditional roll and move games and trivia games and maybe charades and drawing games, and that's all they know. And then throwing down a game like Hamster Roll or Go Cuckoo, like we mentioned earlier, and just seeing them go, whoa, okay, That's different. And then swapping over to something else. Trying to think of a good example off the top of my head. Imhotep is one of my favorite gateway games now, because Imhotep is so unique. It is so different from your traditional roll and move, move your guy, answer the trivia question, miss a turn kind of game. It's completely different. And it blows people's minds. And seeing that look on their face when they discover just what hobby board gaming can be and how much more it can be than what they're used to. I love that feeling. And the best feeling, even better, is when you then later see that person try to show that off to someone else, seeing it spread. So I run gaming events at the local game store, going to the game store, and for one, seeing them sell copies of the games I showed off is one indicator. But then showing up the next week and seeing someone else teach a game I taught the week before just fills me with joy. Seeing that spread to the community. And also running local events, seeing more people come out every week, seeing the overall community grow, and more people just falling in love with gaming. Because I think gaming is the most wonderful thing out there. It is a way to interact with people on a different level that's not so ephemeral. It's not just chit-chat. It's not having drinks together. It's sitting down and doing something and building something and playing a game.
I also love how much of an equalizer board gaming is. You know, you can have a CEO play with a frontline worker kind of thing. I don't know. These are just examples. But you're both just playing a board game.
Totally true.
And Completely true. Experienced gamers and less whatever, you know, but when you sit down and play that game, everybody's on the same level.
Yes.
And I think that's a really powerful thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've seen it in our own lives, even a kid teaching a game to a bunch of adults.
Mm-hmm.
Say, hey, I want to show you this game. It's really cool. And if the adults are gamers, hopefully they won't roll their eyes. And, you know, many adults will do that. But a kid actually sit down and say, like, hey, look at this thing I enjoy and you're going to like it too.
Yep.
And board games is an area where a kid can take that role.
Yeah.
I mean, I just love seeing kids get passionate about something and get their hooks into something and want to evangelize that thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when that thing that they want to evangelize is not like Minecraft or Roblox again.
Damn.
Yep. Don't trust me, my kids are deep into those as well. So I am well aware of those two programs.
All right.
No, like when I two things with my girls that I love seeing. One is I teach them a game and then I come home or I leave my office here and I walk into the front room and they're playing what I taught them.
Yes.
And the two of them did it on their own. That's amazing. I immediately grab my phone and start snapping pictures. I'm like, oh, they're playing the game.
Yeah.
The other is the fact that, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, is the fact that they got involved with their school board game club. And in a way, I have a bit of chagrin because it ends up my kids are being a bit of board game snobs this way. But basically went to their teachers and went, can we play something good? Like, we don't want to play Sword and Monopoly. And introduced their teachers to Board Game Arena. And then went on to teach Splendor and Takenoko. Sorry, Splendor, Takedo, and Takenoko are the three games that my daughter introduced to everyone in the class that everyone's now playing.
Nice.
Awesome.
Nice. Yeah, for us, especially during the summer, like coming out of the bedroom in the morning and the kids are, you know, laying on the floor in the living room playing a game, it's like, yes!
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 Yes! No, I totally get it.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I think it's about time to probably wrap up the show. Mo, thanks so much for coming on and just sharing your infectious passion for board gaming. It's awesome. It's something we love to see, and we're just so glad that you were able to come on the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me here. This has been awesome. This has been a lot of fun. Had some interesting off-topic conversations as well as gaming conversations. Anything to get the word out there.
Absolutely.
Just more people should be playing games.
All right.
Well, speaking of getting the word out there, Mo, where can we find your stuff online?
All right. The thing I say every week many, many times is Tabletop Bellhop, one word. That is where you will find me all over the internet and social media, pretty much every platform that's out there. I at least made an account. We're on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. I did start doing TikToks. So I got about 5 videos up. I'm not so good at it yet. I think I'm a little too old. Maybe my daughter will start have to record my TikToks for me. We are all over the place. And then the website, which is tabletopbellhop.com. Those are the two best places to go. Now, again, our push is to answer your game and game night questions. So if anyone does have a question for the Bellhop, you can send that to questions@tabletopbellhop.com. Or on that webpage I already mentioned, just click on Ask the Bellhop at the top of the page.
All right. Well, Anitra, where can people find the Family Gamers on the internet?
Well, you can find us on all the various social media at Family Gamers AA. That includes Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and, yes, TikTok.
Yeah, we're about as good as Mo at doing TikTok, but we're getting better.
Yeah, we're trying.
Us
old people can get it. You can teach an old dog new tricks.
Yes. And you can head over to the Family Gamers community, which is on Facebook, but the easiest way to get there is to just go to thefamilygamers.com/community. It'll bring you right into the community. We answered a whole bunch of questions even today about an 11-year-old who was looking for some deduction games or something, or mom was looking for deduction games for her 11-year-old, and tons of people hopped on and just started answering and suggesting games, and it was awesome to see. So head over to the Family Gamers community. There's lots of family-focused gamers there who are more than happy to answer any of your family-focused questions.
You can also email us to ask us questions.
That's true. You can. You can find me, Andrew, at thefamilygamers.com.
Anitra@thefamilygamers.com.
Please check out our Family Gamers and Play Games with Your Kids merchandise. This week, we added tank tops because it is really hot outside.
Yes.
And because somebody said they were going to buy a t-shirt and cut the sleeves off to make a tank top. So I figured I would just put the tank tops on there to save them some work.
Next time.
Anyway, you can go to thefamilygamers.com/merch and you can find all of that stuff.
Please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and tell your friends about this podcast and about the Tabletop Bellhop. And leave us a review either at Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you subscribe. Amazon Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, random podcast catcher of choice, we are probably there.
Family Gamers Podcast is sponsored by First Move Financial. Go to firstmovefinancial.com/Family Gamers to learn how the team at First Move Financial can help you pile up the victory points.
Well, I think that's going to be it for us this week. Mo, thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been a real pleasure.
Thank you again.
And when we ever have conventions again and Canadians are allowed to come to the United States and vice versa, hopefully we will get to meet up in person.
Looking forward to it.
So, until next week,
play games with your kids.